This is Maggie Jones and Natural Wonders. I'll be reading another essay by Dave Creer. I hope you know Dave. He's very involved in all kinds of citizen science efforts in the Viroqua area and in the Driftless area. He works for Valley Stewardship Network and was in the aerospace industry for much of his life. He's kind of an engineer naturalist. What a great combination. Just a few efforts that Dave's been involved in: and counting chimney swifts on their southward migration, and counting bats during the summer. And he's been involved in reducing glaring lighting, the kind of outdoor lighting that cancels the darkness at night. Just a few things that he's done. This essay is about the Migratory Bird Treaty Act. Spring brings with it a special hope. As Leopold says, one swallow does not make a summer, but one skein of geese cleaving the murk of March thaw is the spring. Those first robins of the year hopping on the bare ground, the first sounds of cardinals starting their territorial breeding calls, and the sudden disappearance of the juncos as they move north for their breeding season, all reminds us that no matter what else is going on, spring is here. As the days lengthen and the smell of the earth comes back after winter, it's such a joy to witness the bird migration in our own backyards. The Migratory Bird Treaty Act, or MBTA, is a cornerstone agreement to protect the birds which pass through Wisconsin and which we enjoy during spring and fall migrations. It has held up for well over 100 years and is an agreement that has had great accomplishments. The state of Wisconsin has documented about 440 species of birds that have been identified in our borders, many of which we have the chance to see here in the Driftless area. I do most of my birding within a few hundred miles of home, and I've recorded a bit over 150 species of birds, though I'm sure there's a few I've seen but not documented. Birding friends have lists of Wisconsin birds well over 300 species. Still, for a modestly active birder, I've only seen 1/3 of the birds it's possible to see in my own state. Of those 440 species, more than 300 migrate through Wisconsin, not generally staying very long. So we only have a few weeks to see them going north to Canada and the Arctic, or south down to the southern U.S., or Central or South America. During migration, over 30 million birds a night may migrate through the skies above us. Migration and the movement of birds across the globe is a miraculous event. Chimney swifts breed here and in Canada, but spend 60% of their time in the upper Amazon of South America. Though we think of them as a local bird in summer, if we could ask them, I bet they'd consider themselves birds of the Amazon who just come here for a summer visit to eat well on our insects and have families before heading home. Orioles, hummingbirds, catbirds, barn swallows, sapsuckers, nighthawks, all the warblers and flycatchers, they move around our whole hemisphere in their annual life cycle. Some go from the Arctic all the way to the southern tip of South America and almost turn around immediately to start back the other way with hardly a pause at either end. The birds don't care about what borders we put on maps, but are driven by food abundance, habitat availability, nesting sites, and weather. So no matter what we do here in our home in the Driftless area, migrating birds need protection across scores of countries to survive. The Migratory Bird Treaty Act was an effort to help with that. It started back in the 1800s when many species of animals, birds and waterfowl, were hunted to near extinction. Market hunting, or hunting wild animals as a business, was legal in the 1800s and early 1900s, whether it was bison, beaver, waterfowl, and other birds, deer, almost any fish, bird, or animal was fair game with few restrictions. As you'd expect, overhunting led to population crashes and sometimes extinction. Teams of hunters with enormous guns would go out and kill thousands of waterfowl at a time, quickly preserving them and sending them to large cities for food and the feathers. On Chesapeake Bay in the 1870s, over 15,000 canvasback ducks were killed in a single day. Even back in 1634, armed with inefficient flintlock guns, there were consistent reports of over 1,000 geese being killed by one person in a day. For birds, it wasn't just waterfowl like ducks and geese that were the target. Robins were hunted for soup, and meat pies were made with cedar waxwings and goldfinches. Passenger pigeons went extinct, partly due to overhunting for their meat. Egrets were seriously reduced in population for their feathers, for women's fashion. In the late 1800s, recognizing that overhunting was a problem, Forest and Stream magazine advocated for no spring shooting of waterfowl to help the species survive. This would allow the adults to breed and get another generation of waterfowl into the system before a fall hunt. President Teddy Roosevelt, who was an avid hunter, decried game hogs and market hunters and promoted sportsmen's code of ethics to not overharvest birds. Women's groups joined the effort as well, decrying the hunting of birds just so their feathers could adorn hats and dresses. It was reported in 1886 that over 5 million cranes, egrets, and ibis were killed each year in America alone, just for hats. With no restrictions, breeding grounds were targeted where the birds were congregated into dense groupings, making harvesting easier. So in 1903, Teddy Roosevelt protected Pelican Island in Florida, where some of these birds nest. Two Boston socialites, Harriet Hemingway and Minna Hall, started having teas to inform ladies of the destruction caused by the hat industry, which led them to form the first Audubon Society. By the early 1900s, it was a combination of hunters, women's clubs, birdwatchers, and scientists who influenced legislation to start protecting birds. Recognizing that the waterfowl species being hunted were nearly depleted, small steps were taken to start protecting them. The Lacey Act of 1900 was the first U.S. federal law to protect wildlife by prohibiting market hunters from selling poached game across state lines. It doesn't sound like much, a law preventing already illegal game from crossing state lines, but it was a start. The Weeks-McLean Migratory Bird Act of 1913 ended spring waterfowl hunting and the marketing of migratory birds, although two district courts ruled the act unconstitutional. Eventually, the case made its way to the U.S. Supreme Court, but they delayed hearing the challenge as negotiations were ongoing for the Migratory Bird Treaty Act. In 1916, the Migratory Bird Convention was signed with Great Britain and later Mexico, Japan, and the Soviet Union. The arrangement was really with the U.S. and Canada, with Great Britain signing on behalf of Canada, which was still part of the British Empire. This treaty stopped hunting of insectivorous birds, or all birds which eat insects, with the stated goal to preserve species considered either beneficial or harmless to man. Further evolution resulted in the 1918 Migratory Bird Treaty Act, signed by the U.S. and Canada to protect birds listed as migratory. There were immediate legal challenges, as some believed only states had the right to regulate hunting. As Shakespeare said, "All the world's a stage." Unhappy with the new federal law limiting hunting of waterfowl and believing that it was the state's right to regulate hunting, the Missouri Attorney General alerted local newspapers that he was going to go hunt waterfowl outside of the hunting season allowed in the new law, but allowed under Missouri law. He was arrested by a federal game warden with photos splashed over newspapers all over the country, thanks to his alerting the media, and the case ultimately went to the Supreme Court. the court, with the majority opinion written by Justice Oliver Wendell Holmes, held that the MBTA was constitutional. The ruling determined that treaties supersede state law and that the migratory nature of the birds transcended states' rights. The MBTA and these previous acts generally limited overharvest. It was a bit later that habitat protection and improvement entered to help promote the species' survival. President Teddy Roosevelt started the National Wildlife Refuge System, protecting more than 150 million acres. Today, it's up to 850 million acres, including marine acres, partly to help wildlife populations. Even with these protections, during the Dust Bowl, the U.S. duck population fell from 100 million to 20 million in just 4 years, from 1930 to 1934. In 1934, Ding Darling, as head of what would become the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, proposed a federal duck stamp to help raise funds for the government to pay for habitat to protect the waterfowl. A duck stamp, or a stamp for any hunting or fishing, is an additional fee that a hunter pays on top of their hunting license fee, which is used to help promote the species being hunted. This became a law through the Migratory Bird Hunting and Conservation Stamp Act, and since then, the annual hunting stamp for ducks has raised over $700 million for waterfowl habitat. Today, there are 1,093 bird species protected under the MBTA. It is credited with saving some bird species from extinction, including the wood duck, the sandhill crane, and the trumpeter swan. The MBTA was a tremendous success in protecting birds, and it should be celebrated. So how is it that we can hunt waterfowl if the MBTA exists? They are migratory birds and so should be protected. Early on, to help get the legislation passed, there was an agreement that if birds had a healthy population, there could be a minimum 3.5-month hunting season in the fall. The biggest gains from this were that individual states no longer had different rules and spring hunting was not allowed. This flexibility in allowing hunting of specific species for specific hunting seasons is one of the reasons the MBTA has thrived. It wasn't written in stone as conditions existed in 1918, but is allowed to breathe and adjust as nature changes. As an example, in the late 1920s, as wood duck populations plummeted, the MBTA closed hunting for wood ducks. Nesting boxes were promoted in the 1930s to help their population rebound. And in 1941, the Secretary of the Interior and the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service reopened the wood duck hunting season. Many other species have had hunting seasons expand or contract as their populations have changed. The implementation of the MBTA means that, in the United States, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service monitors bird populations of these game birds, and when they are at a healthy level, they allow fall hunting. There can be a lot of dialogue about what constitutes a healthy level of species population. Just as an example, for deer, in Wisconsin, the DNR tracks up to 10 different metrics for deer herd population estimation. It's not perfect, but for birds, populations are tracked, and there are zones with state and local and federal officials meeting, evaluating data and trends, and making recommendations on seasons and maximum bird limits. In general, spring hunting is forbidden for several reasons. First, many birds are on nests to raise the next generation of birds, so killing the parents would damage not just the current birds, but all those future generations as well. Second, it's now recognized as not sporting to shoot a duck that's just sitting there on a nest while in fall, the birds are flying around much more. What are some of my takeaways from all this? Big movements like the Migratory Bird Treaty Act don't just happen. They start out as a variety of groups coalescing around a variety of ideas, starting with small steps and culminating in a major piece of law or treaty. It took over 30 years and a lot of our society's values changing to get the treaty for the MBTA. Second, just like today, there was immediate grandstanding and lawsuits requiring the Supreme Court to weigh in. I just thank goodness we didn't have social media back then. Some folks argue that our legal system is a strength in helping us come to agreements across our republic and helping to adjudicate conflicts peacefully. In the moment, the legal challenges can seem petty and not very relevant to the actual topic or to the average person, myself included. In the case of the MBTA, the case the Supreme Court heard was really about the 10th Amendment and whether a treaty outweighed the state government's right if it wasn't explicitly called out in the Constitution. It wasn't really a case about birds at all. Just as today, it must have been hard in the moment, as birds are dying, to have the temperament and patience for a court case which doesn't seem particularly relevant to play out. Lastly, as much as we hope for the untrammeled nature that Thoreau describes at the end of Walden, quote, "We require that all things be mysterious and unexplorable, that land and sea be infinitely wild, unsurveyed and unfathomed by us because unfathomable," unquote. The reality is that everywhere we look, humans have drastically changed our environment. Whether a bird or animal survives, thrives, or is driven extinct is almost exclusively because we have made a decision about it. In this case, the decision has protected billions of birds, an outcome thoroughly worth celebrating. And that's Dave Creer's essay about the Migratory Bird Treaty Act. I just found an article in the Washington Post. I'll read the first few paragraphs, dated March 10, 2025. The headline is, "Trump Just Weakened One of the Nation's Oldest Environmental Laws." And the text starts out, "The Interior Department has suspended a legal opinion that held companies liable for accidentally killing ducks, cranes, pelicans, owls, and hundreds of other species. In a memorandum dated February 28th but posted online in recent days, Interior's acting chief lawyer suspended every legal opinion issued by the Biden administration, including one that subjected companies to penalties for accidentally killing birds through activities such as oil and gas drilling, wind energy production, mining, or construction. The move delivers a win to the oil and gas industry, which has argued that the government has unfairly punished companies that never intended to harm birds, but it has sparked alarm from conservationists who warn that bird populations are already plunging because of climate change and human encroachment into their habitats." I'll stop there. This is Maggie Jones and Natural Wonders. Thank you for listening.